You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
This episode is brought to you by Hulu Plus. With Hulu Plus, you get total control to watch thousands of shows wherever you want, whenever you want. Right now, our listeners can get an extended free trial of Hulu Plus by going to HuluPlus.com/SGU. Or just go to our homepage and we're going to put a link up for you guys to make it really easy.
Ladies and gentlemen, up next, of course, is the one and only, the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Here's their haiku. Bob, Evan, Jay, Steve. I think the tall one is Jay. Wow, they look like that? Please welcome your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Saturday, July 13th, 2013, and we are live from TAM 2013. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. And thank you.
And we have a special guest rogue this week, TV's John Rennie.
Hello, people of Earth. Thank you very much.
How long have you been living in your TV?
It's a tight squeeze since they got rid of the cabinet sets, but it's great.
Yeah, so John is a new series, Hacking the Planet, which we've all been enjoying. That's going well?
Yes, enjoying it very much right now. We finished up the first season. We'll find out whether the Weather Channel wants to order up another batch of episodes.
All right, so let's get to it. This Day in Skepticism. So this show will air on July 20th. Now, July 20th, 1976, what important NASA-related event occurred on that day? Viking 1. Viking 1 landed on Mars. Now, July 20th, that was also the 7-year anniversary of Apollo 11 landing on the moon, but we've talked about that before. So this year we're going to talk about Viking 1. This was the first man-made machine to successfully land on the surface of Mars. That was quite a technological feat. You know, NASA didn't quite know how to do that up to that point. It's not easy landing something on the surface of Mars because there's not much of an atmosphere for braking or for parachutes. So, but they worked it out in the end. It was a successful mission. And some of you may recognize this photograph. I remember, of course, this is a memory. It's a constructed, confabulated memory, but nonetheless.
It's a reminder more than a memory.
I remember waiting as this image appeared. This is the first image taken from the surface of Mars, and what you're seeing there is the foot of Viking 1, and NASA wanted the very first image. They wanted to make sure that the lander was secure, that it wasn't sinking into quicksand or something. Mm-hmm. You guys remember that?
I do.
Yeah, I remember.
My first memory was I remember people with using pareidolia, like coming up with images or faces that they saw on the rocks and everything. That was a huge thing going on back then.
Well, the face on Mars, Jay, right? The Viking is the one that saw the face on Mars.
Yeah, well, Viking 1 and Viking 2 orbited Mars for months, you know, to a year or so before they dropped their lander, and together they photographed the entire surface of Mars. So yeah, that was the first, I believe, the first time we got the pictures that were interpreted as the quote-unquote face on Mars.
I remember you so desperately were hoping you were going to see something like a Martian lizard underneath that footpath.
Yeah. So Evan and I came early with our families, who are in the audience now in the front row, and we came on Monday, and on Tuesday we did a day trip to the Grand Canyon. We went to the South Rim. The South Rim is a 5-hour bus drive. The West Rim is 3 hours, but we heard the South Rim was better, so we invested the extra time to go there. And it was absolutely stunning. No pictures or video that I saw of the Grand Canyon prepared me for just how awe-inspiring it was. This was the middle of the day when we were there, so the sun was high, which means the shadows were not very stark. What'd you think, Evan?
Oh, it was really incredible, and everything you said is correct, Steve. I do wish that we had been able to stay a little bit longer, because you do see pictures of the Grand Canyon, you know, with the sun setting, and you do get more of that three-dimensional feel to it. I remember at one point my family and I were standing at the edge, and we're like, okay, we just have to do this. We're going to stick our finger out just in case we're living in some sort of, you know, bubble or something to make sure. Because it really does kind of look like that, but your entire field of view is taken up with this incredible scene. It was wonderful.
So I do recommend, if you haven't been to the Grand Canyon, come a day early to TAM next time. Go to the Grand Canyon. Definitely worth it. I do have some interesting facts about the Grand Canyon I want to share. The Grand Canyon is 277 miles long, has an average depth of about a mile, and an average width of about 10 miles. But, surprisingly, it's not the biggest canyon in the world.
Hmm.
I didn't know that.
Oh, the other ones are what, at the bottom of the ocean?
No, no, actually in the Himalayas. So there's the...
Himalayas.
Yeah, the Himalayas. Yeah, so...
is that how you pronounce that?
A lot of people do.
No. Are those people here? Because otherwise we could move on.
A lot of people don't.
The Yanhang Sengo Grand Canyon is 17,000 feet deep, 308 miles long. That's in the Himalayas. Now, what you're looking at, when you see the canyon, this is the south rim, so it's actually not the deepest part of the canyon, but you're looking, you could see all the different strata, the different layers that were laid down over years. And it's interesting that you're actually looking at 1.8 billion years of history just laid out in front of you.
Wow.
Because, you know, of the river carving down. Now, I know we've spoken a little bit on the show before about the controversy over the age of the canyon. I just wanted to recap that because I've reread the whole story. One way geologists date the canyon is by dating the Colorado River, and then the assumption is that the canyon is as old as the river itself. The river is about six million years old. That's when it apparently it broke out of the western edge of where the canyon is now. However, that doesn't necessarily mean that 6 million years ago you had a flat plateau and then the entire canyon was carved over the last 6 million years. It's quite possible that parts of the canyon are more ancient and that the Colorado River occupied a pre-existing canyon. The trouble with proving that is, of course, that over the last 6 million years, the Colorado River has obliterated any older pre-existing canyon. So it'd be hard to know that. Although there may be ends and tributaries that still have some older pieces to it. So there was a study published about a year ago where they looked at the Western Canyon and they dated it to 70 million years, which is pretty controversial. That pushes the date way back for the oldest parts of the canyon.
Do creationists even go to the canyon?
Yeah, hell yeah. We were hoping we were going to run into some, but
yeah.
nobody said anything that pricked our skeptical ears while we were there. So the short story is, 80 million years ago, the entire area was a shallow sea. And then the Colorado uplift occurred, so lifting up the entire region and draining out the sea. When that happened, the sea drained mainly to the northeast, the opposite direction that the Colorado River goes today. And where we are now in the Vegas area and to the east of here, where there was a mountain range. That mountain range about 17 million years ago was destroyed by tectonic activity, by fault lines. So then you have the more modern Colorado River, which is about 6 million years old, now flowing in the opposite direction, you know, from the northeast to the southwest, and that's what we have today is the modern canyon and the Colorado River. So it's the history is probably more complicated, and it's like one of those things where you say, like, how old is the Grand Canyon? You're like, what do you mean by that? You have to define your term. How do you define how old it is? How old is the current structure? How old, you know, do you count just the current process that's forming the Grand Canyon? Do you count canyons that are older but were obliterated by more modern processes? That still count as the Grand Canyon? So it kind of depends on how you frame the question. But so it's still some interesting geological controversy surrounding the canyon even today, but it is a geological gold mine.
Steve, I was curious, were you thinking of that Flintstones episode where Fred and Wilma went to see the Grand Canyon?
Yeah.
And Fred's like, they think it's going to be something big today, someday, but it's this little tiny stream. It was just so tiny.
This is another picture on the south rim. Now, I don't know if you can see it, but right about there, there's a little black dot. You see that?
Yeah.
That is a California condor.
Ooh.
Now, I know that that picture is about as definitive as your average.
I knew you were bringing this around to birds.
But, yeah, come on. It's me. So, you know, that's like a Blob Squatch photo, right? I mean, you can't say what that is. But, you, Jay, you know what the difference is between Blob Squatch and the California
Blob
condor?
Squatch.
That's the difference.
Okay.
That is the same bird.
Wait, you zoomed in and that's what...
No, no, that's a different picture.
All right. You said it's the same bird. I figured you...
Yeah, well, you know, I took multiple
pictures.
Jay,
you pictures. Think that's a gigapixel
camera? Wait, that
camera?
Is the actual same bird that flew closer?
Well, there was like six condors flying around. I got pictures of all of them. Yeah, so...
So it's not the actual bird in your previous photo.
It could be. It's the same...
So you're not sure?
I'm not 100% sure. Now, if you look closely...
This is how it typically is. He's full of shit, guys.
Was I unclear? It was... I didn't notice this until I was looking at the photographs. I did not notice this when we were looking at the condors live, but if you look, you'll see that there is a tag there. Every condor is tagged. I looked it up. There, in 1987, the California condor was actually extinct in the wild. There were no condors in the wild. It was so on the brink of extinction that what the conservationists did is they actually captured every condor that was out there. They had them, then they did a breeding program, an in-captivity breeding program in the San Diego and Los Angeles zoos. And then in 1991, they started reintroducing them into the wild. So the last counting I have is that there are 226 living in the wild and 179 in captivity. That's it. So it's like 400 and something condors in the world. Extremely, extremely rare. And I got a picture of one.
Wow, that is awesome.
So that goes on my life list.
Yep.
They live for 60 years. They're really long-lived birds.
Is it a big deal as a birder to take a picture of one in the wild?
Yeah, to get a picture of a rare bird in the wild, that counts. Yeah,
okay.
That's a big
deal.
No,
I know, but for that bird, is it like, do most people not get that bird picture?
I mean, you have to go to where I was, pretty much. You have to go to the Grand Canyon and be lucky a little bit to see them. So it was cool. It was very, very cool. This is a western scrub jay. This is a very common bird. If you live in the West, this is like a blue jay to us in the East. But of course, if you live in Connecticut, you don't get to see western scrub jays very often. So this was, we had the opportunity to capture this little guy. Very noisy. This guy was extreme. He was so easy to track because the guy was constantly making noise.
Who's that noisy?
Who's that noisy? Yeah.
Well, jays, if you look up the word jay in the dictionary, it's a noisy bird.
Yeah, right.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Noisy. I didn't make it up. I'm serious.
All right, Bob is going to...
I thought you were about to say, and I was in this volcano.
Yeah.
I wish. Right?
Yeah. Speaking of which, we were driving back, and there was this plume of smoke coming up from the mountains, and it looked like a volcano, but it was just the forest fires.
Now, in the right-hand side, you see that light spot? There's a little black dot. That's the volcanic condor that Steve took a picture of.
I thought it was a scene from the new Star Trek movie or something.
All right, Bob, what are we looking at here?
That's the Earth in bad shape, far in the future. The sun is a red giant, and that's the Earth molten and nasty, and obviously no life. What I'm going to talk about is what's going to happen a little bit before that, but I have a skeptic-approved, guaranteed apocalyptic prediction for you guys. Around the year 2,800,000,000 A.D., August 9th, I think, all life on Earth will be extinguished. And there's actually a computer simulation to back up that claim. Now, we've known for a long time that the sun has steadily been brightening for a really, really long time. And the Earth is warming up because of that over the long haul. It's going to be getting hotter and hotter.
Wait, Bob. The Earth warming is because of the sun getting hotter? But didn't Michael Mann just tell us it's...
Well, I mean, we're talking about, you know, that is a fact that over millions of years, billions of years, this is going to be a fact. It's not, you know, short-term... climate that's being caused by the sun.
All right,
don't even get me started on that. But so we've known for a long time that this is going to happen. But this computer simulation did point to some interesting implications. This was run by, let's see, astrobiologist Jack O'Malley James, and he's from the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, and he's presenting this information at the National Astronomy Meeting. So I want to go through this simulation that he ran and kind of walk you through what's going to happen to the Earth. So like I said, the sun is going to brighten, things are going to get hot, water is going to evaporate, and that evaporated water, of course, will increase the rain. And there's going to be, you know, some chemical reactions, and the intense rain is going to kind of wash out all the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And so as the carbon dioxide goes down and down, it's going to reach a critical threshold, and at that point, photosynthesis is going to stop, and that's obviously a pretty bad thing for Earth.
So we got to put more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
Huh?
We got to pump more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah, maybe in a billion years.
We could wait a couple billion years. Then.
Here come the emails.
So this is good. We got time, Steve. This is like less than a billion years. So photosynthesis stopping is obviously pretty nasty. So what's going to happen? Plants are going to die, obviously. Then with all the plants dead, the herbivores are going to they're going to die. How many vegetarians are in the audience? Raise your hand.
Clap.
Okay. Well.
It's like three people out there.
They're all holding turkey drumsticks, so that's not going to happen.
Condor drumsticks, yeah.
Well, for you three people, it's going to be a very bad day. After that, of course, the carnivores are going to die. So what's going to be left, guys?
Cannibals.
Huh?
Cannibals.
Cannibals.
We'll resort
cannibals.
To cannibalism.
Okay. No, they're going to be long dead. What's going to be left are the microbes. Bacteria, yeah. Archaea, fungi, things like that. So they're gonna stick around for a while, of course. So and they're gonna actually re-inherit the earth like they did like many millions, billions of years ago. So then after another billion years, though, it's gonna get even hotter and hotter. So there's gonna be a tiny subset of the microbes that are left. And can you guys guess what's gonna be left after when it gets even really nastier?
Republicans?
No, it's going to be the extremophiles. These are the bacteria and archaea that've got amazing metabolisms that can withstand the intense heat and aridity. A lot of the water is going to be gone, so they're probably going to be kind of holed up in like under the earth, under the ground, in small pockets of water or at high latitudes probably. But then even they have limits, obviously. So after 2.8 billion years, all life is going to be dead on Earth. The last microbe will die. And that's going to be it for life on Earth.
But Bob, that's going under the assumption that our technology isn't going to be, you know, like a rock star a billion years from now. And also, like,
yes, it is.
We don't even know if we should even be calling it like humans at that point. We're not going to be human in a billion years. We're going to be self-evolving ourselves. You know where I'm going with this, right?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. But the implication,
we won't even be on the Earth anymore.
You're saying this is more of a future robots problem.
Yeah.
I will let them deal with it.
No, Jay, that's true. I think one of the problems with this is the idea that, first I want to talk about the implication for extraterrestrial life, because what these scientists are saying is that this can really help us search for extraterrestrials, because when you look at exoplanets, and if you've been following astronomy news, you know that we've been finding like an exoplanet every day. But the thing is, we never look at these planets from a temporal perspective, because you got to consider where it is in its life cycle. If it's earlier in its life cycle, like the Earth, then you should look for maybe oxygen or ozone as evidence for life. But if it's in the later stages of its evolution, then you shouldn't be looking for those things. You should probably be looking for methane if you want to see some evidence of life. So that was pretty much their argument. But so Jay, those are good points, and these are some of the problems, I would say, to their point of view. I think, and Steve, I'm curious about your take on this, extrapolating biology, some sort of biology, what, 2 billion years, 2.8 billion years, who knows what kind of uber bacteria could evolve in another billion years compared to what we know, and who knows what kind of effect they could have on the atmosphere. So that's something that, you know, it's hard to take into account, but it's something that's just an interesting aside to what they were talking about. And then, of course, you've got, the post-humans or post-aliens that might be living on the planet. They could have some sort of effect. And they transcend biology, so you can't really use biology to think of what kind of effect it would have on the atmosphere. Or, of course, any robotic descendants could have some interesting effects as well. So
all right.
That's all I got.
So we're all going to die is the bottom line of all that.
Happy, happy, happy. Yay.
Evan. Yeah. There, and this is another sort of regionally related item. This is Death Valley, and apparently there's this enduring mystery about these sailing stones through Death Valley. Tell us about that.
Oh, yes, indeed. This is kind of a quick news item that we're going to go through. So the Weather Channel's website recently ran an article about the sailing stones of Death Valley. So these rocks are moving across the ground all by themselves. And for the better part of a century, scientists have not been able to explain exactly what's going on here. And no one would really note that these rocks were moving if it were not for those nice defined trails that you're seeing there. And some of these stones are very heavy. They weigh about 700 pounds, some of the heavier ones. And they're leaving trails that are thousands of feet long. These sailing stones were first reported in 1915. They've been investigated by geologists from UCLA and the U.S. Geological Survey. But they've never seen the rocks in motion. Now, there are some hypotheses as to what's going on here. Rainstorms, perhaps, they cause little flash flooding, and followed by intense winds, they could possibly be moving some of the smaller rocks, but it really doesn't account for the big boulders. They're just too heavy for that.
Could it be a prank, like crop circles, where people are running out there and kind of making these little trenches?
There is no evidence that there is anybody messing around with these things.
Evidence from evidence.
Yeah, right. No kidding. another one is gravity. So where this particular plateau is, it's not exactly 100% flat. It's pretty flat, but there are differences in the pitch.
But they're going in different directions.
Yeah, they wouldn't be
crisscrossing. That is the point.
They hit a little gravity pocket along the way.
Although, they do predominantly go in the same direction.
They do. But at the southern end of the playa, which is this dried up lake bed in the valley where this is happening, it's where some of the rocks are beginning their journey, but the southern end is a few centimeters lower than the northern end. So how do you account for these things going uphill? You really can't.
Evan, are any pseudoscientists saying anything like ghosts are pushing them or Bigfoot? What's up?
No, they're really not. Nobody's kind of taken hold of this and ran with it. I mean, but I wouldn't be surprised if there are people out there saying, oh, it's ETs or, you know, other supernatural forces at work. There's vortices and magnetic fields.
Well, maybe they're trying to communicate with us. I mean, is the letter X, right? I mean,
X marks the spot.
We should dig underneath there.
X marks the spot always, as we all know. But the mystery seems to have finally been solved. So,
don't ruin our fun, Evan. You going to solve this
one? The gentleman's name is Ralph Lorenz. Not Ralph Lauren. Do not confuse that. Ralph Lorenz is a professor at Johns Hopkins University. Actually, a planetary scientist. He's a NASA planetary scientist. And he was working on a project. He was setting up some weather stations in Death Valley a few years ago. And here's what he had to say. He said, I was intrigued, as everyone is, as I had this instrumentation I was using in the desert locations during the summer, and we realized we could use it during the winter and try to understand what the conditions really are at the playa. So he noticed that the paths of the stones are intersecting like this, and they should be on sort of this collision course in which they would eventually kind of bounce off each other. But what he noticed, really what was happening, is that one was sort of altering the course of another, as almost if one of them had a force field around it, which was altering just slightly the trajectory of the other, collisions were not happening. And he remembered reading something similar to this occurring in the Arctic, regarding Arctic boulders. So he decided to do a little experiment. And the weather data that he had collected told him that the desert can get cold enough for something similar like what's going on in the Arctic to be happening here in Death Valley. And he made a little experiment. Here's what he said. I took a small rock and I put it in a piece of Tupperware. And I filled it with water so that there was an inch of the water with a bit of the rock sticking out of it. And he put it in the freezer. And then that gave me a slab of ice with the rock just sticking up a little bit. Then he would take that and he placed it into a large tray of water with sand at the bottom. And all he had to do was gently blow on that rock on the ice. And guess what happened? It moves across the water and voila, you get a rock drawing an impression in the sand just like this. So their research team made some calculations and that under certain winter conditions in Death Valley, enough water and ice could form to float the rocks across the muddy bottom of the playa in a light breeze. That's all you need. And it would leave a trail in the mud as the rocks moved.
So wind is blowing 700-pound rocks.
Wind is, but you need the help of ice and some water.
Coefficient of friction.
Right. There it is.
Evan, how long does it take for this to take place?
4'1".
Oh,
no. How long does it take? That's a good question, Jay. The article really didn't say too much about that, but over a long course of time, they do move, as one person did say it, as a sort of a glacial pace, if you want to take that for what it's worth.
It's kind of interesting that the trajectory of the rock doesn't change very much during that time, yeah. But I guess that comes back to those other factors of the overall terrain and the tilt of that.
Right. Hmm. Correct.
Why don't they just put a camera, a video camera down there?
From what I understand, there is now footage of, time-lapse footage of the rocks in motion. So go ahead and look that up online if you actually want to see these things in motion.
But it's amazing it took them almost 100 years to figure that out.
Yeah, I don't know why they couldn't come up with this, you know, very eloquent and simple, as far as I'm concerned, idea, and you know, to just do a little experiment with a little Tupperware and a rock and some ice at home. Right. I mean, anybody could have done this over the course of the 100 years. You're right, Steve. It's remarkable.
All right. Well, thanks, Evan. Yep. So when John Rennie agreed to sit on the stage with us today, I asked him, said, John, what news item do you want to cover? And John said, balls.
Well, That's right. And it wasn't just an exclamation at the time. No, actually, it's sort of a news item. It was news to me.
That monkey has blue balls.
Well, yes, he actually does. Now,
electric blue.
Now, it's possible that's because he hasn't found another little female monkey, but that's really, among this particular species of monkeys, the bright blue coloration of the scrotum is basically his way of saying, hey, gals, I'm available. But, you see, Jay, this leads me to raise a question. I put it to you. Why do you have a scrotum?
What?
I will broaden the question. Not so much why do you specifically have a scrotum, but why does any man have a scrotum?
It's the cooling effect. I like to keep him cool.
Yeah, well, you're a very casual guy that way. But that is the explanation that we pretty much all hear. I mean, it's pretty much as every man can attest or attestees. They're having your very delicate testicles hanging outside your body inside this sort of soft sack is leaves them painfully vulnerable to any kind of hard strikes to the groin, not to mention the possibility of, because of the anatomical arrangement, for things like debilitating or even fatal hernias or torsions. So this seems on the face of it like a really maladaptive arrangement, but the answer that most of us do learn back in high school or whatever is exactly what you're talking about, the idea that nature in its infinite wisdom let us evolve scrotums so that the sperm, which need to develop at a lower temperature than our body temperature, that they would stay cool, and that's why it is that we have scrotums. So it seemed as though the scrotum evolved along with mammals, and it just seemed like sort of an awkward but necessary compromise. Here's the problem, though, that was outlined in this wonderful simple story that appeared very recently on the website Slate. The problem is, if you start to look back at the animal kingdom and try to reconstruct the evolutionary history of the scrotum, it turns out this testicle cooling rationale doesn't actually hold up quite as well, or at least it gets a lot more murky than it was. The first obvious problem with it is that birds have internal testes, but birds have higher body temperatures than most mammals do. So it's not impossible for sperm to be able to develop at a higher body temperature. And then second, there are some mammals like armadillos and elephants and sloths that do have internal testes. If you think about the back end of an elephant, think of what you've never seen there. And the thing is that in some of the cases, some of these animals, like whales, it's pretty clear from their evolution that their ancestors did have scrotums at some point. So they somehow managed to evolve adaptations that allow their testes to work just fine inside the body.
Well, the water's cold, and every guy knows what happens.
And over evolutionary time, it's a good Lamarckian arrangement on that. But the best hypothesis right now is that the earliest mammals actually all had their testes inside their bodies up inside near their kidneys. This is actually the arrangement you see in some of the oldest, most primitive sorts of mammals, the monotremes, things like the egg-laying mammals, things like the platypus.
And so, John, we were talking about this. It's like interesting that we really only know that from extant, you know, living animals. You know, testicles don't fossilize, as far as I know. So we don't know if they're internal, non-descended, internal, descended, or external in a scrotum. Except now we're starting to examine the genetic evidence,
right,
which is helping us figure out the phylogeny of dissension and testicles.
So does that mean this is junk DNA?
That's good.
That's just painful to contemplate.
Always going for the low-hanging fruit, Evan.
Steve, now you said that they don't fossilize, but why do we call them stones then?
Good point.
That was three in a row, by the way. Thank you.
Well, if you're curious about the first scrotum in history, it probably belonged to a marsupial, because that seemed to pop up after about 100 million years of mammalian evolution. Interesting point. The scrotums of marsupials are all in front of the penis.
In front.
Yes, sort of on the other side they would hang over if they were standing
up. They just
up.
Get everything backwards in Australia.
I'm saying Coriolis forces have something to do with it. I don't know. But then again, so marsupials evolved scrotums, and then later, independently, scrotums seem to have evolved in some other mammal lines, but even within those, some branches seemed actually to lose them. It really, all these different sorts of variations really just basically suggest that it's not really clear that natural selection gave us the scrotum, as a way of helping us keep sperm cool, or whether something else drove us to have the scrotum first, and then the requirement of keeping sperm cool came up after the fact.
Yeah, so it's interesting, because, you know, if the scrotum evolved in ancient mammals, then it would have had to have been lost in subsequent lines. But the fact that, you know, the marsupials and the placentals have the opposite arrangement suggests that they arose independently,
right,
which would mean that the more ancestral mammals didn't have scrotum, even if they were partially descended or whatever, we don't know. But therefore, they must have had some adaptation to having the testicles be warm. Or the other possibility is that I came across when reading about this is that maybe their need wasn't as great for the temperature regulation, because it's not just that the one other factor is not just that we became endothermic, we became warm-blooded, but that our sexual reproduction required storing large amounts of sperm that could all be released at once.
Right.
And that really made, you know, so it's the storing that needed to, that made the cooling so important. So maybe early mammals, you know, just didn't need to store as much sperm as we did.
Right. That kind of, they talk about it, that as a sperm competition hypothesis. The idea that when the male would mate, he would want to throw as much sperm as possible at the situation to make sure that he would increase the odds that he would be the one who would actually be fertilizing an egg. That's not the only hypothesis that's around. Another possibility is actually the one that our little monkey friend actually perfectly embodied. It's a kind of sexual selection hypothesis, which is that...
So it's women's fault is what you're saying.
Well, it's that they are there for the ladies. It's basically, the idea seems to be that it's either something to help draw attention to the penis, or to suggest that I am such a strong, fit male, I can actually walk around with this kind of handicap. Seriously, that is one of it. I mean, another possibility, and it's sort of interesting, is one study that was done suggests that most of the mammals that have external testicles and a scrotum, they seem to be ones in which they are capable of certain kinds of very fast movements, ones that would involve lots of fast movements with the body getting compressed. Yeah. This is called often like the galloping hypothesis. And the idea is that kind of motion changes the fluid pressures inside the body cavity so drastically that it would potentially risk just sort of crushing the testicles from the inside, which sounds like a fun weekend.
I'm still not buying the whole attraction thing, and it leads me to ask this next question, so I hope nobody gets offended. Ladies, by a round of applause, how many of you are actually attracted to testicles? Not that many.
Now ask the men.
Conversely, I'll ask this. How many of you are attracted to men who don't have testicles?
Okay.
Throw that out there.
Point taken.
Sorry. Right. So that's what I got, Jay. What about you?
Yeah. Well, that, as fascinating as this all is, I do have a hankering for a quickie with Bob.
Oh. Steve. Thank you very much. What happens at TAM stays at TAM, right? We're good with that?
Okay. What happens at TAM stays at TAM, yeah.
Okay, this is your quickie with Bob. And the SETI and NASA and what's that?
International Astronomical Union, okay. IAU.
They finally named the moons of Pluto. They're P4 and P5. I think we talked about this last year. They did not use Vulcan, but they did come up with Styx and Cerberus as the new names for Pluto's moons. And this has been your Super Quickie with Bob. I hope it was good for you, too.
All right. Thanks, Bob.
Is that fast enough, Steve?
Yeah, it was fast.
You went about 2 seconds over. So we're going to take a break from our live show at the Amazing Meeting to do an interview with the amazing Randy himself. But before we get to the interview, we're going to talk about this week's sponsor, Hulu Plus.
Bob, I can imagine... You're hitting the Star Trek pretty heavy, huh?
Oh, yeah. I watched pretty much all the classic next gens. They're just so amazing. It was so incredible to watch them after like over a decade.
Yeah, I'm partial to Enterprise.
And Steve, you've spoken so much on the show about Battlestar Galactica. I can't wait to get caught up with Battlestar Galactica using
you
Hulu
mean,
Plus.
Evan, you have not seen all four seasons of Battlestar Galactica.
Binging on whole seasons, to me, is you know what makes Hulu Plus so amazing. To watch five or six episodes, one right after the other, to me, is just what it's all about.
Yeah, this is the whole on-demand streaming thing. I mean, you could stream HD movies. You guys remember when we had to wait minutes to download like one little picture?
Minutes.
Yeah, and right now, for any podcast listener, you get an extended free trial. It's up to 2 weeks now. So you can really get a lot of time in. Check out what Hulu Plus had that you guys like. I mean, the list is huge. I was just going through it again yesterday.
So guys, here's what I did. I went to theskepticsguide.org and I clicked on the Hulu Plus banner, and that's how I'm signing up for my subscription.
Yeah, definitely do that. Go to our homepage, click on the Hulu Plus banner. That way we get credit for your free trial. Or you could just go to huluplus.com/SGU. And if you want to stay with Hulu Plus after your two-week free trial, it's only $7.99 a month.
And guys, don't forget the amazing idea that they had was that you don't need to buy a special device to connect to Hulu Plus. You can watch it on your internet-capable TV, game consoles, Blu-ray players, Roku, Apple TV. It's amazing where you can get this in so many different places.
Yeah, so if you want to show your support for the SGU, go to huluplus.com/SGU.
All right, guys, thanks a lot. So now let's go on with our interview with James Randi. We are sitting here now at the Amazing Meeting 2013 with James Randi, the man himself. James, welcome back to The Skeptic's Guide.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be here. Always is.
And we're also here with Jamie Ian Swiss. Jamie, again, welcome back.
Greetings.
So, Randi, you announced, don't mind getting right into it, you announced at TAM this year that you were recently married.
Yeah, that's quite a story. It starts in 1930. And for 27 years, I've been living with my partner, Davy Pena. We've been happily associated, let's say. It was about 2.5, maybe 3 years ago. Now, I came out as being gay right on my webpage and such. Not for any particular reason, except that I had never told anybody. Mm-hmm. But all my relatives, all my friends, all my associates knew. It was widely known among people who, I guess, should know. But it was obvious. I didn't have to, I don't wear skirts or anything like mm-hmm. that, but I didn't have to tell anybody. They knew from association with me. And then I realized I'm coming out with my next book. Funny you should give me a chance mm-hmm. to plug it like this. Thank you so much.
Oh, no, you're welcome.
Yes, A Magician in the Laboratory. Not lavatory, in case you're wondering.
Oh. I have pulled some magic stunts in the bathroom.
Oh, I'm sure you have, and I don't want to hear it.
No, okay. They flush that title.
They're good stories, actually.
Rimshot. Yeah. So that is the title of it, and we spoke today with the producers of the film. It's really fine work, and I trust these guys implicitly. They've played square with me all the way along. I wouldn't trust anybody any more than that.
This is the documentary film,
yes.
An Honest Liar,
that we did a session
yes. about at the conference.
Yes, and I'm very excited about it's coming out. It's coming out. Get it? Eventually. I don't know exactly what the release date will be, but it will certainly be announced, and we'll make a big noise about it at that time, won't we, Steve?
Absolutely.
Okay. The whole concept of the wedding thing was, well, it was pretty well forced upon me and Davy because there are only 13 areas in the United States at present that allow same gender. I don't say same sex, you see. Same gender marriage. And so we had to go all the way to Washington, D.C. from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, in order to perform this ceremony. It was very simple and direct. We signed a couple of papers and paid a small fee, and it was done. And so I'm now married. And I'm even wearing a ring. Look mm-hmm. at that.
Mazel tov.
Son of a gun, yes. A wazzle tov?
No, it was him. It wasn't me.
Yeah, okay. No.
Randi, were you ever married before?
No, not that I remember.
Yeah, I didn't hear about it. So.
At my age, I don't remember everything. You know, yeah. It might have occurred, but no, I'm pretty sure of it.
And was there any particular reason that you decided to get married now? Was there any
yes.
other impetus?
The Supreme Court is making changes in the law, as we all know. And it's been on the news for forever now. very encouraging, very, very encouraging. They're beginning to understand that there are other folks in the world who are honorable folks, accomplished folks, honest folks who need that sort of association. I'm very proud to know that I'm in a world at this particular time. I want to live for another 40 years at least so I can see the outcome of this whole thing. Mm-hmm. But the laws are changing very rapidly. And it does, after all, it doesn't make any sense that I can get married with Davey in D.C., Washington, mm-hmm. D.C., and then I go to Georgia, and they don't recognize it. Come on. Yeah. Marriage is marriage. It's recognized. It should be recognized in all 48 mm-hmm. states and areas and territories and whatnot. Absolutely. No question of it.
Randy, what's your book about?
I'm handling it's a magician in the laboratory, and I'm handling all of the situations that have arisen over my lifetime, a long lifetime, I'm happy to say, where I've been actually invited and forced my way into laboratories all across the world where so-called scientists known as parapsychologists have been doing research, and they think they know what they're doing. And I've been able to show in every case that I investigated that they were wrong because they don't understand that they can be tricked. Mm-hmm. Magicians can fool scientists easier than they can fool the layman, because the scientist thinks in a straight line, A to B. There's the shortest distance between A and B is a straight line. However, you can get there other ways, you see. In two or three dimensions, you can get from A to B without going in a straight line, and magicians do that. I know that's a surprise to everyone present, mm-hmm. but magicians actually do it, not necessarily in a straight line. And scientists don't think that way.
Yeah.
Little kids are the hardest people to fool.
Really?
And the reason is they're not smart enough to be fooled. Mm-hmm. It's a very strange sort
because
of
they
thing.
Haven't, because we are always using people's assumptions
yes.
against them. The assumptions that are fundamental survival tools, right? They're uniquely right. human, cause and effect, anticipating outcome based on previous experience. We use all of those assumptions. It's a distinctly human trait, a cognitive trait that is most of the time plays to our advantage, but also leads to magical thinking, that you can't separate the one from the other. Sometimes it leads to magical thinking. Sometimes it leads to scientific thinking. And so we are, as magicians, are always using those assumptions against people. And a young child, you know, you've always had the adults have the experience of watching the kids' birthday party show, and the kids are fooled and entertained, and all the adults, they can see through the magic. But it's counterintuitive to think that the converse is also true. Mm. That sophisticated magic that fools adults, the child now has that experience of saying, oh no, it's in the other hand. Because we are using these assumptions, mm-hmm. and a child has not yet learned to make those assumptions.
Right.
It's the same thing as, you know, in proofreading. I often use on stage for this a demonstration, the old keep off the grass,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's an adult's intelligence that lets them, that keeps them from seeing the extra the, keep off the
yep.
grass. And when I use this, once somebody misses it the first time, you're now very safe most of the time to say, thank you for trying. I know you're sincere, but I'm going to tell you, you've made a mistake. Please read it aloud again. And people repeatedly now, because they've locked into that perception, they'll never see it again. Whereas a child, and that's because there's these clues. It's an outdoor scene. It's a sign. It's the grass. It's
right.
the sun. They've seen that sign a million times before. Keep off the grass. It never said keep off the grass before. Why should it say that now? Again, this is a survival skill that mostly
yep.
serves us very well, but can be turned awry by people like us, or people using it, for, you know, to ill purpose as well. But the child who's learning to read doesn't take all the context in at all, doesn't make the assumptions based on prior experience, and says, keep off the grass. Sure, what's the question?
Yeah, right.
That also points to the fact of how reality is a constructed reality. We're not directly observing reality. Our brain is creating it, and that's just one minute.
And trying to make sense out of it. And
right,
our brain's always trying to make sense out of what we see. And more often than not, that works.
Yes.
But sometimes it doesn't.
You've therefore shown the scientists that they can be fooled. So how do they react to that? Are they accepting of their limitations, or do they, you know, hunker down and get really, you know, fierce and defend themselves?
I find that they tend to just ignore it. They just sort of like, well, really, that was interesting. And they move on to some other subject. But I'll tell you another thing I do with the scientists. I often get this question after talking at some prestigious university or college, wherever it is. I'll get somebody will afterwards when I'm talking with the academics, I'll get one of them will often say, but you know, people out there in the public who believe this sort of thing, telepathy, ESP, talking to the dead, they must be really stupid. Mm-hmm. As soon as I hear that, the flag goes up. They don't see it, but I know it went up. And I say, take me to your library. Then I will take me to a bookcase or a library, mm-hmm. and I'll do mm-hmm. a bit of mentalism, like having them select a book and then select a word out of the book on the other side of the room, and I'm able to tell them what the word is, and they'll say, wow. And I'll look at and say, wait a minute, are you stupid? And they get the uh-huh. message right away. And yeah. I often have people they come over and they say, you made your point, Mr. Yeah. Reddy. And that's a gracious way that they can accept it. And they often do. They realize that it's not, I can't knit, for example. I can mow a lawn, but I can't knit. I can do calculus.
To learn.
But yeah. I can't mm-hmm. do a lot of trigonometry. I don't understand at all. But you see, the fact is, that doesn't make you stupid.
Right.
That just mm-hmm. means this is not part of your experience and your learning.
Yep.
It's an easy confusion to make, the difference between being fooled or being a fool. Right. And yes. one can make you feel like the other, but they're really not the same thing. And my experience to your question is, you know, you find all kinds. And I tend to think less of the scientist and academic type who is resistant to magic or takes offense at it, or, you know, right away their ego comes up and they're feeling stupid or defensive or whatever. But, you know, I think we're a little spoiled in the skeptic world. We tend to meet scientists who really take a joy in their work and a joy in the understanding of the world. And I like to think these are markers of great scientists, quite frankly, right? Because I think wonder, which is often talked about in the context of magic or the context of children or childlike wonder, I don't really believe that at all. I think wonder is an adult, sophisticated emotion. It's not about not knowing. It's about knowing. People who really know how the world works, who know how the universe works, also know more about what we don't yet know. And I think when you stand on that threshold of knowledge and not knowledge, that's where real wonder occurs. And so I think great scientists tend to see magic as a burlesque mm-hmm. of their work and tend to really delight in it. Richard Dawkins loves close-up magic. I mean, I've performed around him many, many times, and he really delights in it. And the very first time we met, which is years ago now, and I did a little magic after dinner. And at one point, he said, kind of spontaneously, he says, it looks bloody supernatural. Now consider the source, right? Yeah,
right?
And I said, can I quote you? And he said, no. but since then, but I've told the story since, and he said, no, you can quote me now.
Randy, I like asking this question of people who have been doing this for a long time. So you were there literally at the beginning of the modern skeptical movement.
Yes.
So let me ask you, how do you think we're doing? What do you think we should do differently, if anything? And what do you think we should be doing in the next 20, 30 years?
Well, from the point of view of the JREF, the James Randi Educational Foundation, I must say I am very, very satisfied with the influence we are having. It's difficult. It's a very tough road to travel. It's very difficult to make progress on it in such a way that you can say we've proven this, we've proven that. Now, Peter Popoff, for example. On the Carson Show, we proved that Popoff right. was cheating. He was lying. He was faking it. But that didn't make any damn difference.
Yep.
Now, after Carson died, I looked into the matter. Popoff, the year after Carson died, Popoff brought in $1.1 million more than the year in which we exposed him on right. the Johnny Carson Show. Mm. And that's fantastic. And Carson would be totally amazed right. at that. Carson used after his retirement, he used to call me, about once every 10 days or so, and we'd just chat. He'd always apologize. Oh, I'm taking too much of your time. Could John take too much of my time? No way. And we used to chat, and he'd say, I just saw Peter Popoff on television again. Okay. As if he had assumed that he'd be wiped out.
Yeah.
Now, these are the unsinkable rubber ducks yeah. because yeah. the public insists they just want to ignore that. They shake their head, they close their eyes, and they may do the little Three Monkeys thing. I don't know.
Yep.
I've never seen them in operation. But it is astonishing. What we've got to do in the skeptical movement, well, it's all education.
Exactly.
You know that, Steve. Yep. All of us here know that is education. It's informing people. And that's what we try to do right here at the James Randi Educational Foundation, TAM, T-A-M, the amazing meeting that we're attending at this very moment. That's our purpose, is education. Get those people out there. Now, this audience is pretty well informed, mm-hmm. because they're members of the JRF, you see. But we've got to get them to get out there in the masses and in schools and whatnot and inform people. Get them convinced that there are alternate ways of looking at these things. Don't just accept that someone's speaking to someone dead. Mm-hmm. And make recordings and make notes and fight this thing. It's a battle. It's a terrible battle. We don't win it easily. But when we win certain aspects of it and everything, we celebrate the fact and we look at the wall, we see the writing on the wall. Damn, there's a list there we can't possibly live through. It's just incredible yep. how many times we have to be reversed and thrown back, but we got to go right back into the fight.
Are you happy with what we've accomplished in the last 30 years?
Yes. I'm quite happy. Well, with people like you, Steve, after all, let's face it. You're a scientist who has came over to our side. You were already there. Mm-hmm. You didn't have to come over to our side at all, but you were thinking rationally and acting rationally, and you accepted the premise that we laid out. And it was yours. It was yours as well as ours. And we saw on the same level, and we saw to the same depth on these things that we've both been fighting it. Mm-hmm. And while we're on that subject, I've got to thank you for being on our side all this time.
Oh, my pleasure.
Well, that's powerful. My appreciation, as I said earlier to this crowd, my appreciation for the fact that we've got over 1,000 people sitting in that audience, and they're on our side. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing is, there are lots of couples there, men and women and children, kids that are wandering up and down these halls and coming over to me and asking me for an autograph and a handshake. We've got to get to the kids, and we've got ethnic groups of all kinds here and different countries. Mm-hmm. We've got India, we've got Australia, well, all over the world. Yeah. People have come to this meeting. I am so flattered by that. We have a big reach. The point is that we've got a battle still to fight, and we've got to fight it very, very hard. We can't slow down. We can't give up. We can't back up at all. We've got to fight this battle.
Mm. It's endless, but
it's
because human nature is human nature.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not going to
change. Remember, the verb that you use when you say people like to believe this. No, people need to believe this. You've got to correct that verb. Don't say they just want to believe it. They need it.
Right. So how do we fix that? How do we make it so that fewer people really need to believe in the paranormal or things that are not true?
By getting them, forcing them to think. Mm-hmm. Forcing them to think. And the learning modules that the JRF is turning out now, you've seen them and you've contributed to them, of course. And I think that's a good move forward. It's costly to turn them out, but we are supplying them. And we'll say right now, if you want learning modules for teachers to hand out to students and such to enable the students to do tests of these claims themselves, design their own test as to how they will prove or disprove them. And those modules will teach you that sort of thing. Write to us. Get in touch with us. We're on the internet. We're all over the internet. Please write to us, and we'll be glad to send them to you. No cost.
And all of those units relate to the fundamental issue of teaching critical thinking tools in different ways. It's not just about teaching about a particular subject, parapsychology or cryptozoology or whatever it is. And those are all useful models. But in the end, all of those teaching tools and all of the materials we're putting out and the battle you're fighting as you frame it is to inspire people to learn the benefits of critical thinking. Mm-hmm. You know, we were talking just the other day, Steve, you told a great story last night about, a failed diagnosis, and it wasn't a fail. You made the superb point as a teacher yourself that it wasn't about the medicine or the technology or even the doctor's medical knowledge. It was a failure of critical thinking that led to this tragic misdiagnosis. It's a universal issue. It's not just about Bigfoot.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
I think another element is the fact that we have to also accept that we're not going to change and fix every one of these problems during our lifetimes, that it's generational, mm-hmm. and that, you know, passing on our knowledge as skeptics to our children and also trying to influence our local schools, you know, like, why aren't we teaching kids more critical thinking? Like, people don't, the general public doesn't have a very good idea of what critical thinking is. We don't put an immediacy on teaching it to our children. And I think these are things that an average skeptic can have an influence on. Get involved in your school boards. Teach your own children. And then, you know, as kindly as you can, you know, try to help your friends and family understand critical thinking better. And, you know, don't be so combative. Be understanding of the fact that they simply just don't have the tools that you have.
I've had a couple of cases where parents, where I'm going to speak at a school, I've actually had a small group of parents all smiling and greeting me and whatnot, along with the principal or the dean of the school. And they say, but Mr. Andy, we would like to specify one thing, please. Parents here are very sensitive about religion, so you won't mention religion at all. My answer always is, I don't use religion as part of my lecture, but if I'm asked any questions about religion, I will answer them honestly. In many cases, I've been asked to leave, and I did leave gladly, because I won't be censored that way. Yep. Religion is subject, as all subjects are, to investigation and questioning.
Exactly. Yeah, of course. I mean, we, like on the Skeptic's Guide, we try not to bring in politics or religion unless they crisscross science.
Exactly.
Right. So we're not there to just beat down on any particular, you know, political point of view or a specific religion. But look, they're giving us plenty of stuff to work with because they're crisscrossing science all the time.
Oh,
so
yes.
We do talk about it.
Oh, yeah.
And this is where skepticism addresses the issue, the longstanding subject of testable claims.
Right.
That's really what we're talking about.
Yep. Exactly.
Yeah, the way I look at it, anything worth addressing, we address.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, when it comes to just personal choices of belief or values,
oh, no.
We're not there to impose our values on other people or to tell them what they can or cannot think or believe. Just these are the skills of critical thinking, and they apply to everything.
Randy, congratulations on your marriage.
Well, thank you, sir.
Well, thank you, Randy. Thank you, Jamie, for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Randy.
Always great to be on the show.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
It's time now for Science or Fiction. We are going to be joined on stage by another special guest, Deirdre Cross.
Cross.
Deirdre, come up on stage to join us for Science or Fiction. Deirdre was at the SGU dinner last night and won the privilege, really, of sitting on stage with us while we do Science or Fiction. She asked us to promise that we wouldn't humiliate her, but of course we refused. All bets are off. All right. You know how we run these during the live shows. I'll read you the three items. We'll poll the audience. We'll get our expert opinion from the skeptics, and then we'll see what influence they had on the audience. And then I will do the reveal. Item number one. Scientists have successfully transplanted insulin-producing islet cells from one species to another, which survived without the use of immunosuppressive drugs.
Hmm.
Item number two. For the first time, astronomers have identified the color of an exoplanet, a blue world that may get its color from raining glass. And item number three, researchers report that they have successfully treated a genetic disorder in two patients by deliberately infecting them with HIV. So first we're going to get the audience's opinion. If you think that item number one about transplanting islet cells is the fiction, applaud. Okay. If you think that the exoplanet raining glass is the fiction, applaud. First two sound pretty even. And if you think that the deliberately infecting a patients with HIV is the fiction, applaud. I think I'm going to call that a three-way draw. I don't know about you guys.
Just about, yeah.
It's pretty close.
All right. Jay. Go first.
Doesn't the guest always go first?
No.
Okay. All right. So the first one about transplanting the insulin-producing islets. Never fails.
Glad you went first.
Yeah, you do that on purpose, don't you?
No, I really don't. I'm just not smart. You know, without the drugs, without having any kind of drugs introduced or whatever, which means that the body doesn't recognize it as a foreign object. Which is strange, but I don't see any reason why that, you know, something couldn't happen. You're not giving me any clues, so I'll stop looking at you. The second one about raining glass on this blue planet, and they're identified the color of the planet. I see no reason to think that that's false. The raining glass thing seems a little stretching, but that's probably, I can kind of extrapolate that they're just maybe surmising that
that might be happening depending on what they're detecting and the color of the planet. And the last one about the HIV, I just can't see any possible way that people would inject deliberately inject HIV into anyone. So I'm going to say that one is the fake.
Okay, John.
Okay. I think, you know, number one, the idea of trying to transplant the islet cells from one species to another, that kind of xenograft is something people have been wanting to do for a really long time. I know people have been looking after that for a long time, but I don't think they've managed to do that. I think the identification of the color of an exoplanet is really cool, but I think that may well be the case, and I can believe that the raining glass is sort of a creative interpretation of the idea that there are silicates or something descending from the sky. And I know that HIV has been closely studied as the idea of a really great vector, unfortunately, for being able to try to transfer genetic information into cells, possibly for therapeutic reasons. So I'm going to say that number one is the fiction.
That the transplant.
Yes, yeah, the transplant is the fiction.
All right, Deirdre, before you give your analysis, tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm from Santa Barbara, California, and this is my first TAM, and thank you. And it's been a wonderful experience, and you know, doing everything has been great. And I could really drag this on because I'm clueless.
Okay.
Thank you for dumbing it down for me.
So tell us what you think about these three news items.
I'm suspicious of number one.
The transplant one.
The transplant, just because the lack of immunosuppressive drugs doesn't seem quite right to me. I do believe number two is a definite possibility of being true, even being able to determine that it's, as some one of you said, a silicate or a glass. Number three just sounds kind of creepy, but I can imagine that it being a retrovirus might be able to do something useful. I'm going to go with number one as well.
Okay. Evan?
I'm going to also go with the cross species without the immunosuppressive drugs as the fiction. I think it's, you know, challenging enough to deal within the species without the immunosuppressive drugs, let alone the cross species aspect of it. I was thinking exactly what John was thinking. They're on their way, but they're not there yet. That one is the fiction.
And Bob?
So for HIV-1J, I understand your reaction to that, but maybe 20 or 30 years ago, it would be a better reaction. But these days, I can imagine somebody with a really nasty genetic disorder, and if somehow infecting them with HIV can deal with that, that actually would be a nice compromise, because you can survive with HIV and live a natural life these days. So I could see that as a worthwhile compromise. The second one with the exoplanet, yeah, I've got no problem identifying the color of an atmosphere from such a distance. There's lots of ways to image that or infer that. The glass, yeah, I agree with John. It could be some sort of silicate, and they're kind of guessing that that's probably how that's happening. The first one, though, yeah, I mean, what a breakthrough that would be, dealing with diabetes, the islet cells. But xenograft, good word, John. I didn't think of that. That was very nice. But yeah, that one's without those drugs. Yeah, that's fairly dramatic. I'm gonna have to say that is fiction as well.
Okay, so I think it's Jay's by himself with the HIV. Everyone else went for the xenograft. Everyone likes the xenoplanet. So quickly to the audience, we'll see how influential they were on you. If you think that the xenograft is the fiction, applaud. The blue world raining glass is the fiction, applaud. And deliberately infecting with HIV is the fraud. Definitely an influence. One was, I think, the clear winner there.
Yeah.
Two and three equally, you know, in second place. So we'll take these in order. Scientists have successfully transplanted insulin-producing islet cells from one species to another, which survived without the use of immunosuppressive drugs. Most of the panel here thinks that that one is the fiction. Jay thinks that that one is science. And that one is science.
J, Jay, you didn't win yet. Calm down.
Yes, I did, because I read the news article for number two.
It's a moral victory, if nothing else.
Don't get ahead of yourself.
No, I know it.
This is huge, though. I mean, this was very surprising. When I read the title, too, I'm like, all right, xenograft, that's hard enough. Without immunosuppressive drugs, like, whoa. But what they did, this was researchers at Northwestern University, Stephen Miller and others. They took transplanted islet cells from a rat to a mouse, wasn't a human. The goal is, though, to get to pig to human. That's the goal. And that would be potentially a cure for type 1 diabetes. Type 1 diabetics, their islet cells are destroyed, usually young in life, because of an autoimmune disease. Type 2 diabetes is the one you get from being older, and that's insulin resistance. You still make insulin, but you're resistant to it. Type 1, they don't make insulin. So this could be a potential cure for type 1 diabetes, or at least a really effective treatment. So what they did was they took rat splenocytes, which are white blood cells from the spleens, and then they injected them into the mice. And then they transplanted the islet cells. The islet cells, however, were still rejected because the mice made antibodies against the islet cells. So then they said, okay, what they're going to do is they're going to destroy the B cells, which make antibodies, in the mouse, so that it won't make antibodies against the islet cells. And then they did that at the same time they transplanted the islet cells. This is in mice that were treated with the splenocytes. And then the B cells recovered, so their immune system recovered, so they didn't permanently wipe out the immune system. But when the B cells recovered, they treated the transplanted islet cells as self. They were tricked into thinking that these islet cells were part of the natural body. So there was these islet cells survived and produced insulin without any rejection and without any immunosuppressive drugs for 300 days, which was as long as they followed the mice. So they never were rejected. Amazing. Absolutely. Now, the difference between rats and mice is not as great as the difference between pigs and humans. So this doesn't mean that this will necessarily translate into the ability to transplant pig islet cells into humans with type 1 diabetes, but it certainly is very encouraging. And this technique itself could be a really massive breakthrough, because lifelong immunosuppressive drugs really suck. It's really, if you have to do it, you have to do it, but it is a huge compromise that you make when you need a chronic immunosuppression.
I'm happy to be wrong under those circumstances.
Yeah, right. Cool item. All right, so let's go to number two. For the first time, astronomers have identified the color of an exoplanet, a blue world, almost the color of Earth, actually. The same kind of blue as Earth.
No. The article said it's a deeper blue.
It's a deep blue, but it's kind of an azure blue. It's compatible with like the Earth's color. But it's a hot Jupiter. This one is science, as Jay already gave away. It is a hot Jupiter. The planet is HD 189733b, love those sexy names, 63 light years away, not very far, and this was identified with the Hubble. The Hubble is still out there doing some work. It's always good to know. The surface temperature is about 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit, and they estimate that because of the temperature difference between the light and the dark side, that the winds are probably at around 4,500 miles per hour. So imagine getting blasted with 4,500 mile an hour winds of raining glass.
Yeah, they said that the glass is actually going horizontal.
Yeah, it's basically a horizontal, hurricane of glass. And it is silicates.
Like, yeah.
It is just like silicates solidifying out of the atmosphere, which basically turns into raining glass.
So really, so almost as bad as the weather in Florida most of the time.
Yeah, almost as bad as Florida. That's right. All of this means that, number three, researchers report they have successfully treated a genetic disorder in two patients by deliberately infecting them with HIV is the fiction, for the obvious reason that you're not going to deliberately infect patients with human immunodeficiency virus. But this was a plausible item in that HIV is a retrovirus. A retrovirus is a potential vector, meaning that you can use it to put a gene, a working gene, into the cells of a person who has a defective gene. They have a genetic disorder, and you could literally cure the genetic disorder by doing that. Now, this was based upon a real story. These are scientists at the San Rafael something institute. My autocorrect changed the name for gene therapy. It's not the Telethon Institute. It's something that was a word like that my autocorrect fixed. They treated two patients, one with metachromatic leukodystrophy, which is a genetic neurological developmental disorder, and one with Wiskott-Aldrich syndrome, which is an immune dysfunction disorder. These are patients who get immunodeficiency, but also autoimmune disease, and they get cancers because of their dysfunctional immune system. They treated these two patients. What they did was that they took hematopoietic stem cells. So these are stem cells from the bone.
From the
bone marrow that write poetry, but while they're doing that, they also produce blood cells, which is what hematopoietic means. Yeah. And they treated those stem cells with retroviral therapy with a modified HIV virus. So they didn't infect the patient. They just used a modified HIV as a retroviral vector in order to put working genes into the stem cells of these patients. Then they put the stem cells back in their body and they produce blood cells and reproduce the gene, which then made the protein that was missing. And that's
where the zombie apocalypse comes
that's
from.
That's where the zombie, that's right. So the metachromatic leukodystrophy, that's a brain disease. So these cells had to get into the brain and had to produce the protein in the brain, and that happened. So they successfully treated two patients with really horrible genetic diseases with this therapy. At least that's what they're reporting. You know, this is still needs to be vetted and replicated, et cetera.
By a round of applause, how awesome is it that I won Science or Fiction by myself this year? Thank you. At Tam. It's pretty epic, Bob. It's pretty awesome. I think I'm on top this year, too.
Used to being on the bottom, Jay, right?
Thought the spiritual discussion was
with
over.
My junk DNA.
All right, so we did something different this year. In past years, we've done live questions from the floor, but quite honestly, we want to pick our questions. And the audio is better. If I could read the question actually into a microphone, it works a little better. So what we did was, over the last 2 days, we had little cards at the table, and we did also at the SGU dinner, and we allowed people to write questions and submit them to us, and we picked a few. We have 4.5 minutes left, so maybe we'll be able to get through, you know, two. I have three questions here. We'll see how many we get through. So the first question that we chose is, what is it that stops you from slipping into cynicism? How come you don't wake up every day and say, ah, screw it, let the gullible people fend for themselves and I'll be okay? So
I disagree with that premise.
Yeah.
Because what's the premise?
The premise that we haven't slipped into abject cynicism. I mean, all right, not all the time, but every now and then I'm just like, screw this. What the hell? How could people do this? But then I recover. But
then it passes. Yeah.
It's the fight that's worth fighting for. I mean, all of us here are passionate about our critical thinking, and we're seeing an effect. I mean, we just had a conversation with Randy yesterday where Steve asked him, you know, what have you seen in the skeptical community over the last 30, 40 years change? And Randy, it was so encouraging to hear Randy say, I've seen a dramatic change. It is working. And we all need to push hard every day. And, you know, it's mm-hmm. And coming to TAM is like, this is like refuels me emotionally for the year.
Yeah. I'll add, too, that the other premise is that people who are fooled are gullible. And, you know, we've heard from lots of people, that's not true. Anybody right. can be fooled.
Anybody.
No matter how smart you are, no matter how much you know, there's always somebody out there who could know more than you and who can exploit that knowledge to fool you in some way. I wouldn't blame the victim. That is the allure. That's the trap, to blame the victim. And we have to constantly remind ourselves that that's not an appropriate approach to take. Anybody can be fooled, and that's what we're constantly fighting against, the fraudsters, the fakers. Or if we fight the fakers because they're exploiting just being human. If you're human, you can be fooled, and that's why we need critical thinking. We need people with expertise in deception, in science and pseudoscience to try to at least fight back against the fakers, and that's how we don't slip into the cynicism of blaming the victim. Right. Anyone want to add anything to that?
That was great, Steve.
Perfect.
All right. Thank you. That one guy over there, I appreciate that.
That's your mom.
All right. Another question. How can I prove that I'm not on Monsanto's payroll? I was accused of that this morning. P.S. I'm not. So,
John had a good answer for that one.
Yeah, give us your answer.
Well, I mean, the question is, I think that since they have asked you to prove a negative proposition, you should ask them, what would you accept as sufficient proof that I am not in the pocket of Monsanto or anybody else?
Or Big Pharma or whatever.
Right. Yeah, that's, I mean, right. What they've made a certain claim, they've made a certain accusation, what would they accept as proof. Because if anything else you throw, they're just going to just disbelieve. Then there's no point in having the conversation anymore. But just make it very clear. Yeah. They basically just accused you of something and have no interest in listening to any alternative.
They accused you of something without evidence,
right,
without any real reason to do so. They're doing it as a way of completely dismissing your opinion and of insulating their opinion from refutation.
And yet they're maintaining they're being the more reasonable people in that
situation. And so what you do is turn it right around to them, and that's I often do that. It's like, well, is there any evidence that could possibly prove to you that I'm not a member of the conspiracy, whatever the conspiracy is? In this case, it's Monsanto, which, in case you need to know, is like a big agribusiness company that is the focus. They're the boogeyman of the anti-GMO crowd. Mm-hmm. If you disagree with them, you're a shill for Monsanto.
I tell them, just look at the car I'm driving. I'm not making any big money.
Evan, what did you say?
If you wanted to take the question literally and say payroll, so you'd get a W-2 from them and you just turn over your tax returns and it's got to be there. Yeah. So if you want to get technical.
Very, very quick anecdote to finish this, then we'll go to the quote. I was actually emailed by a PR person from Monsanto. And they said, I read your blog. I wrote a blog about one of the crappy anti-GMO studies, debunking it. And they said, you're a science educator. You're doing good work. We like that. They were very vague. They didn't really ask me to do anything. It was just sort of, we like what you're doing. And I emailed them back. I said, if you like what I'm doing, then leave me alone. I cannot talk to you. I cannot in any way interface with you. I have to remain completely, and they totally got it. But it was like, I can't touch you with a 10-foot pole, because then any opinion I have from that point forward is tainted. I need to be able to say, even though I don't think I would be influenced, I need to be able to say I have absolutely zero ties with Monsanto or any big company or a big farmer or whatever. This is independent opinion.
You should have just sent them to me.
Yeah. No, that would have been dangerous. All right, Jay, finish us out with a quote.
This quote was sent in by a listener named Jim Preston, and Jim pulled a quote from episode 86 of our podcast. Perry had a really interesting quote that we thought was the timeliness of it was great, because we just interviewed Sanal about his whole experience in India and how he had death threats against him and how Sanal is fighting back this horrible thing that's going on over there. And you should read more about it. We don't have time to get into it now. But here's Perry's quote. He said, if you strip the horrors of history from history, the flip side of that is you strip the nobility of rising above such horrors. And that is a quote from Perry DeAngelis.
Yeah.
Perry. Thank you, Jay.
Thanks, Perry.
Thank you, everyone, for coming to TAM. Thank you to James Randi, DJ, the J-Ref, for hosting us again. Thanks for all of my hosts, John, for joining us.
Thank you.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The incomparable Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Ladies and gentlemen, give it up for him. Come on. Oh, yeah.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. And don't forget that this episode was brought to you by Hulu Plus. To sign up for your free trial of Hulu Plus and start watching your favorite shows right now, and for an extended free trial, go to HuluPlus.com/SGU. That's HuluPlus.com/SGU. Or just go to our homepage and there will be a link right there for you.